And I think there are a few people who are stuck in traffic and running a little bit late there.
Sorry, we're going to give them a few minutes.
I don't know if it was something that I'm doing wrong because I planted 20,000 to 30,000 bushels there last year, right when they're moving.
What's the salinity up there where you're at?
It's up to 12.
Oh, that's good.
Stinger
is
saying
around 10 to 12.
Oh, yeah, that's good. So that's
where is that exactly?
To change the fall configuration, press
the red pen.
Yeah,
that's good.
You will now be placed in the conference. After joining the call, to record the conference for those who need
We transplanted 200,000 bushels from horse head.
I'll let them know.
To squash this hole.
I saw that when
There's a piece of ground. We did so
if
well.
You get, have you passed Rip Rap Road yet?
I'm going to do it again.
Okay.
And plus with the president, he talked that.
Okay. All right.
Axe down to 21.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, seafood industry.
I'll let Andrew know.
So if you have a bad year, don't make no money this year. You can get
you've passed it
from the 2 years back to bring to it.
Okay. That's
something to think
about. Yeah, it is.
I understand. Well, we'll see you shortly.
Look at that.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Oh, great, Andrew.
Were those monitors already here? Is that something that?
How you doing?
Technology. It's hard to
I'm all right.
That's better that technology than what we had. Oh, look at that, would you? Well, in the back of me, too.
Lakey called and said he's coming, but he's in traffic, so go ahead and start with that.
Yeah,
that's one heck of a monitor. Look at that.
Yeah, they got one on both sides of those two and both sides of those.
Next week will be
I had a visitor coming up here telling me.
Oh, yes?
Yeah, snake in the truck. I had to get over that spot this year.
Where at?
It was in the floorboard. I go right before I got y'all town priest. I went right in the medium and got over that one.
He'd own the truck if that was me.
He paid him right
now. It'd be his truck, huh?
If this meeting is at 6 o'clock, I'd go right. I never drove her down this night. Deputy was 2 feet on behind me. He seen me when I ran up on the medium. He
got out of the truck, so he pulled up to see what the hell was doing.
It's called a road for you.
That's right.
Plug it in and see if anyone went
to play. Yeah, I think it is. So when he opened the door, he took his stick and ran out the other door.
Then, also
then I made him slide to see if he could look all in there.
I got a Vassara Lynx on the right here for you.
Okay.
I don't know when it got in there, because I ain't drove truck a couple months, you know. But I would have come down, it's been 6 o'clock. If I go home to dark, no.
Flash, man.
Ain't no higher.
So what, and what did
the same thing say?
That's what it was set up for. Oyster, that's what grabbed me. Was. I get
Oyster House Oyster.
That you? Hey, Don. Dan there. How's it going?
All right. I talked to Don. He's on his way, but he's in traffic.
Okay. Thanks.
We have a farm there and several others.
Put that out there for you.
Balls,
several other watermen
undertaking.
Very good. All right. That's drive back. Very good. Thank you.
Something caught by, and I said, They had to raid in the hood.
Check us out. We do tours and
you say when you're ready.
Go ahead.
But we're in that same bracket.
All right, we'll call the meeting to order. SMAC meeting for May 16th, 2019. I'd like to thank all the members of the panel for being here. Thank the audience for being here. I think we have one member on the phone, is that right?
Yep, Dan Dice, Tangier's there.
Hey, Dan, can you hear everything okay?
Yes, so far, Ian.
Okay, now I guess we'll turn this meeting over to Mr. Button now and he can go through with his agenda.
Thank you, Chairman. What I guess we'd like to do is go ahead and we'll start with introductions for folks on the phone and folks who might be listening to the recording there. Then I'll go through the agenda there. We'll go ahead and start with the introductions.
All right, let's go ahead down here with all the way on the left.
Tommy Kellum, Kellum Seafood, Weems, Virginia.
Beverly Mamaw Ludford from Pleasure House Oysters on the Lynn Haven.
John DeMaria, DeMaria Seafood, Newport News.
J.C. Hudgens, Matthews, Virginia, representing Virginia Watermen's Association.
Wayne France, Northern Neck Waterman.
Cody Metcalf, Eastern Shore, Ballard Fishing Oyster Company.
Ernie George, Waterman.
And this is Andrew Button from BMRC here. We also have Roger Mann from VIMS, Melissa Southworth from VIMS, Ryan Carnegie from VIMS as well, and they'll be speaking there. And Patrick Gear from BMRC and Ben Stagg from BMRC as well. Okay, so what I'd like to do at this meeting is, it's more of a sort of background information to sort of make some decisions at future SMAC meetings. So I've asked folks from the VIMS Shelf Pathology Laboratory to come in today to sort of update the advisory committee on shellfish diseases, as well as the VIMS Molluscan Ecology Program. They are the program from VIMS that works very closely with us, sort of in partnership with VMRC on our fall patent tong survey, as well as all of the surveys that we do there here, and they're going to be here to sort of provide some background information on both a survey, sort of how that works, as well as sort of emerging issues, concerns, good news on shellfish pathology and disease. But to sort of start things out, just to sort of get everyone thinking about oysters a little bit and sort of some background I was going to go through, and I apologize if some of you have seen some of these slides before, just sort of a little bit of a history and overview of what we do as oyster managers here, sort of a little bit of history of what VMRC has been doing for 90 years now in terms of replenishment and restoration and management of public oyster grounds, just to sort of inform a discussion that I think will be starting at the end of this meeting today that will carry on at future SMAC meetings, and hopefully have a little bit of a forward-looking season approach to go into this season, sort of looking ahead, hopefully beyond just one season at a time, sort of at the end of a couple more SMAC meetings is where I'd like to hopefully get everyone to, and with your advice, hopefully get that done. So with that, I'll go ahead and do a little bit of background here. So really, in terms of what we do as managers, there's sort of two buttons that we can push, and that's really harvest controls and replacing shells or seed. And I kind of look at that as really the harvest controls there are sort of like the brake pedal. So we have a brake pedal, and we can let off the brake or we can step on the brake in terms of areas open to harvest, the lengths of harvest, bushel limits, gear types. Those are all sort of the brakes that you can tap on that. And you look at replacing shells, and that's really not really a gas pedal. I would consider that sort of a fuel tank. So it doesn't really necessarily speed things up. That gives you something to work with. And if you don't have any gas in the tank, it doesn't matter how much you let off the brakes, you know, you're not going to go anywhere. So those are really sort of a simplistic form of what we can do here as managers, are sort of those two things. This is just for the benefit of looking back on the history of what we've been doing here. This is actually our 90th anniversary of replenishment this summer. So we've been planting shells as a state agency, formerly the Commission of Fisheries, since the summer of 1929. And that was actually when, you might recognize some of the names in there, the first Oyster Advisory Commission was established way back then. And some of the same areas were planted back then. It talks about planting there in the Rappahannock and Chincoteague Bay in an area of the James River. So we've been at it a long time there. And then you step forward a little bit there. 1968, these are pulled from one of the benefits of moving is going through all your old files and boxes there. But I'll send out a copy of this to everyone there. But you can see that even back in the 60s, we were planting millions of bushels of shells, both house and I guess they called them reef shells back then. But we planted over 13 million bushels of reef shells throughout the 1960s in response to the MSX and disease outbreak that was going on in an attempt to sort of restart the fishery there. So we've basically been doing more or less the same thing for close to 100 years as an agency in terms of fishery management. And that's, I believe, one of the reasons why Virginia is still one of the places that has a successful public fishery, one of the few places left that does that, is because of advisory committees and commissions like you and VMRC's fishery management. So we've been collectively together keeping this fishery going with its ups and downs for a long time. But you can see that it's not the fishery that it once was, and it probably never will be. It's just a matter of biology and the amount of resource that's left the bay over time. But this sort of covers your more than 100 years of replenishment and harvest history there. So you can see here is where there was really actually lots of overfishing occurring. There was too much resource coming out. You can see this pretty steady drop to right here. Remember that 1929 date when actually oyster restoration, replenishment, large-scale shell planting started? You can see that actually had an effect there, that fishery, the number of harvest bushels started to recover until you get to 1959. And if you know your oyster history, that's when MSX really started having those large-scale impacts there. So replenishment continued, but it just couldn't really keep pace with the impacts of disease that were going on at the same time. So you can see that's where this steady decline in the fishery was until the almost near moratorium there in the 1990s. This is just a little background on harvest compared to gear types. So you can see that in the 1980s, which is sort of comparable to the level of gear types that we currently have in the fishery, the harvest was a little higher. But the dominant gear was patent tongs, and the dredge numbers have stayed about the same. You can see this is that low point in the mid-90s, and you can see that as the harvest amounts began to recover, it wasn't just that there were more oysters in the water, but we were transitioning to a more efficient gear type. You can see the number of hand scrape licenses being sold increased, and the number of patent tong licenses that used to catch more oysters than that are, you know, switching to that different gear type there. So you can see this sort of shift in gears being used at the same time that, yes, the oyster population is recovering there, but also we're switching to a more efficient gear. This is sort of a breakdown that I'm sure you've seen of the public versus private to sort of see where we are in 2017, 2018. And you can see that since really 2014, 2013, we've been pretty stable. I mean, there's been some fluctuation in the fisheries, but a lot of that up and down is related to good years in spat sets, bad years in spat sets, but it's been about the same number of participants, the same rotational areas, the same harvest areas open, and we've been pretty consistent. I mean, part of the reason that we've been consistent is we have been getting consistent spat sets, consistent replenishment, but if any of those things change, we'd anticipate that you'd see some drop loss there. And this is just sort of a breakdown of what that graph actually shows there, is there's sometimes the misconception about aquaculture and private harvest. Sometimes folks will sort of consider them the same thing. But this is actually an updated slide for just the 2017 calendar year. And what's interesting is this piece of private ground or private ground production is actually traditional harvest. So that's dredges, scrapes, tongs. This is your wild harvest, this 42% over here. So that's public ground wild harvest. And this 24% is actually the amount of oysters that are definitively produced in oyster hatcheries, so containerized oyster aquaculture there. And that's sort of the breakdown of where the oysters are coming from on any given year. So you can see that, you know, more than 70% of the oysters are actually dependent on, for the most part, natural spat sets, seed movement, just general the production that comes not from the hatchery, but from the natural resource itself there. So that 25% is actually in containers. The rest is, I call it wildish or traditional harvest. This is a little bit of a breakdown of actually where that production is coming from over the last 3 years. So this is 16 and 17 and 18 calendar years combined. And you can see the majority of wild ground harvest, this big piece of pie, is from the hand scrape or the oyster scrape there. The next biggest piece is the oyster tong, ordinary tong there, so that's your hand tongs basically. So that's market harvest oysters. So 21% are still being caught by hand tongs on average over that 3 year period. Oyster dredge there is 12%, oysters by hand, and then patent tongs are 3% there. So those are small pieces of the pie, but they used to be much larger there before this hand scrape piece of the pie was there. Before that was there, the oyster dredge is about the same, but everything else was patent tongs and hand tongs, basically. So this 63% is sort of a new gear type that wasn't there, you know, in the 80s when harvest numbers were the same. These were the number of licenses sold in 2018. So you can see that, again, hand scrape there on the left dominates the gear type sold. Patent tongs have increased. I mean, they were in the 30s or 40s. In terms of number of gear licenses sold up until the last 2 years. And this is actually that 900 number is a number of people who are eligible to participate as of this year in the oyster fishery. So that is the number of user fees available.
Do you have that number as far as actually participated in the fishery?
I can pull that out. It varies there, but there's a, in terms of the number of user fees there, about 30 to 40% aren't really participating much, but at varying degrees of participation, but I don't have that ready to go. So there are some people that clearly are, you know, have their 40 days or more, and there's some that have a couple days, so it is a pretty good spread. But it's been pretty consistent, about 300 to 400 consistent participants in the fishery for the last 3 to 4 years. And I'm just going to touch on sort of the shell planting a little bit. I think Roger Mann from VIMS is going to get a little bit more into that with the survey there. But I'll just get sort of the warm-up there for him. So the big button that we press there in terms of shell planting is really based on the fall patent tong survey and is based on the volume of shell on the bottom. So ideally, We want areas to be above that 10 liters per meter squared. You can see that if they are above there, there's literally enough room for there to be a good spat set. So that 10 liters of shell is basically a bucket about that big, and it's just enough oysters to cover one oyster shell thick on top of an oyster rock there. So literally, if you get below that, if you have a good spat set, there's just physically not enough room for oysters to attach to. So that's sort of the minimum you need there to take full advantage of a good spat set. And that's the level that we plant right on top of harvest areas. So that's light enough where you're not actually covering up any live oysters if they're sort of patching in between, but it's enough that with those live oysters there, if you do get a good spat set, you know, they'll attach right there, and those areas will recover there. If you get below that 5 liters there, there's really just not enough shell. That's less than basically one shell every other spot, so there's just not enough area there for the new recruits to attach to. And that's really what we're doing with replenishment, is we're looking for the areas most in need, and there's always more areas in more need than we do have funding and shells to cover. But that's what we do in terms of have been doing for a really since the survey began there in the 1990s, just to keep these areas going. And of the 250,000 acres of baler, 46,000 acres on the seaside, in any given harvest year, there's about 75,000 acres open to harvest. If you look at a full bayside rotation, including all the areas in the Rappahannock, about 125,000 acres is open to harvest over a full 3-year rotation cycle. And of that acreage, we're surveying about 10,000 acres annually, and this actually represents the best parts of the oyster rocks there. So those large areas in the Rappahannock, one harvest area in the Rappahannock is about 4,046 square meters or so, or acres, excuse me. And of that area, only a small piece is actually going to be an oyster rock there. So those great big polygons that I showed in the last slide, you can see those cover a much larger area than the area we're actually surveying. And that's basically sort of a rundown of where we've been and where we are today. I'll come back on at the end of the VIMS presentation so to get some discussion going and sort of talk about questions you might have for me going forward, discussion amongst each other on what sort of our options would be. But this is just sort of to provide some common background before we hear from the folks at VIMS on the survey and on oyster disease there. And this is actually just a nice break video there for us of some shells going over on deep rock in 2017. There on this is 20,000 bushels of shell being planted there. Reef shells there that you guys were working on if you were working on deep rock the last 2 years. So that's how we're planting reef shells these days. You can see they're going over pretty slowly there. Getting a good spread.
Where did you find those shells?
Mm-hmm.
Find those shells out there?
And just as an update before the VIMS folks come on here is the shells that we planted there at Nansman Ridge 2 years in a row now. We've got two boats moving those. We've had a load go up to Waterview there, the Rappahannock, two loads to the Ucomico, and the first load there, Dan, went over to Shell Rock there in the Pocomoke Sound on the eastern shore over there.
The load that went up that day?
Yep.
I see.
So that's a little update of where we are now. And all the replenishment contracts for shell planting and some of the stonework that we're going through, we're still on pace to gear up here early June through July for a lot of shells going over. So once you get there.
So these plantings that we're getting, the spat from Nasman Ridge, economically we're doing very well with that, right?
Yes, yep. No, we've been able to both, if you take the cost of planting there and the cost of moving there, it's less than what it would cost to buy and transport seed from hand tongers, truck it over to these areas. So even if you include the cost of planting the fossil shell and catching it, it's less than $10 a bushel to both plant the fossil shell, catch the fossil shell with the spat on it, and then transplant it again. So, all right, I'll turn it over to Roger Mann of M's here.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Close out of there, you got it?
Yeah, we'll be fine. All right, let's see. Committee members, it's always fun to come and talk to you.
I'm glad to have you.
Isn't this nice?
Great.
This is really nice. It dawned on me as I was coming in here today that I've literally spent half of my life now talking to this group. I'm 67 years old, and this is my 34th year of doing this.
Wow.
It's always been a good conversation. We haven't always agreed, but we've always agreed like gentlemen, and I think that's sort of one of the niceties of being here. Andrew started off with a little bit of history, so let me give you a little bit of history in that, you know, I arrived here on January the 2nd, 1985. That was the day after the famous Hail Mary pass that, you know, Doug Flutie's, do you remember that one?
Oh, yeah, I watched it.
I was a successor to a remarkable man by the name of Dexter Haven, who'd spent over 30 years working with most of you in the oyster industry. I inherited a program that had some good points, and it had some points that needed a bit of improvement. Those of you who will remember the days of the middle 80s through the middle 90s as being a really dark period in the history of the fishery here, and it had nothing to do with you or me. It had everything to do with disease, and it was always a matter of when is the man upstairs, or should I say the lady upstairs, I'm not quite sure which, going to give us a little bit of break from that. Ryan's going to tell us some stories about that a little bit later. One of the things that we tried to do during that period, though, Jim Wesson came aboard down here at the commission. We became good friends and cohorts in crime. One of the things that we wanted to do was to try to put together a quantitative stock assessment, because one of the great problems that we've always had is actually putting numbers to what's going on out there. Dredge surveys are good, but they have their real limitations. And so in 1993, Jim and I started our first attempt at a stock assessment, and it was an interesting few days in the James on a waterman's boat in absolutely miserable weather, trying to work out how to do things. And let me say that as somebody who'd come from New England and working on clam boats, it was a steep learning curve. Took me a while, but by the time we got to 1998, we had a reasonable idea as to what we were doing. A new boat, the Baylor, had become available. We'd worked out how to use an hydraulic patent on, and we got into a decent sampling scheme. And from then on, we have run a quantitative, very important stock assessment program every year since then. Now, I say we. In fact, at this point in time, it's Andrew and it's Melissa who run this. I deal with numbers. They are much better in the field than I am. And what I'm going to do today is to take you, first of all, to something that sort of tells that story on the web. If it isn't on the web, you can't tell it. There is too much information to try to summarize it for you, and so I'm going to take you to a place where you can go and look at all this stuff. And if you go and you Google something, V-O-S-A-R-A, it even works on your cell phone. My kid's cell phone that he decided to upgrade, you know, that's how Dad gets them. There's the bank of Mom and Dad that pays for his, and I get the cast-offs. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. You end up with this place called the Virginia Stock Assessment Replenishment Archive, and what we tried to do here is to take the enormous amount of data that comes out of these surveys every year and distill them down so that people can see the story of what's going on. The underlying data in this is probably now somewhere in the region of 3.5 million data points, and we had about 500,000 a year to this, so there's a huge amount of information. And if anybody is so masochistic as to want me to explain all of the details of that, set aside a day and I'll be happy to sit with you. What I'd like to do is to sort of go through how you might find your way around this and see what you can find. So you get to this site and you see the familiar map. And so we want to have some information on somewhere that's up in Burwell's Bay. So we're going to choose ourselves a reef somewhere in the James. Now, many of you are quite familiar with what's going on down here. So we can either go down in the river, or we can go up into Burwell Bay, or we can choose somewhere like Point of Shoals. And so what we're going to do is we're going to choose Point of Shoals. Whoops. Sorry? This one?
Yeah.
I don't use these sorts of computers, so this is always sort of interesting to try and get me to use. So we go to somewhere like Point of Shoals, and if we can scroll this whole thing down, then what you get is a history that's written out, and it'll give you something that tells you what the oysters are like from 1998 through 2018 in terms of the spats, the markets, the small, and these are densities per square meter. A square meter is about the same size as the top as this. There's a couple of things that we want to do when we do this. First of all, you'd like to know how good recruitment is. Simply look at the size of the green bar. You'd like to know what the status of the markets are. Look at the red bar. Look at the transition from year to year. Look at the trend over the period of time. Is it going up, down, staying the same? Are we seeing violent fluctuations? Are we seeing things disappear? You can go into this site, and there are lots and lots and lots of reefs. And you can pick your one, and you will see a graph like this. And every year, Melissa updates these, and we put them up here. So what do we see just as we look at this one? Total number of oysters. This was during this dark period. We had a good year in 2002, but really things started to sort of come back to life sometime after 2006, 7, 8. It's been pretty good since then. And these numbers, they don't look like very much because they're all on a scale, but these numbers have been pretty good. So we get ourselves one way of sort of showing you how things are going along in terms of that particular reef. Now, it's not just all about oysters. We spend a lot of time talking about shell. We can also do a lot of interesting things when we start to look at the amount of shell that's out there. So over again that period of time, how much shell was there on the bottom? So here we see this sort of generally pretty good trend over a period of time. We're up here at 15 liters per square meter. 10 liters per square meter is a layer this thick. Okay, this is not a reef. If you spread them all out like tiles, that's how thick it would be. Now, they aren't spread out like tiles, but it's a simple way of trying to sort of depict whether or not we've got a lot of shell. Now, this is the brown shell. This isn't the stuff that's sunk into the mud. This is the stuff that's old, dead, dying stuff, and it's sitting there, and this is prime substrate. This is prime real estate for them to recruit on. So you look at this, and you think, well, over time, this is pretty good. Now, this one's a little bit worrying here because, you know, this year it sort of did a dive. 1 year, don't get too panicky about it, but if you see this thing start going down, then we need to have a conversation about it. And then we have a history of whether they were open, closed, et cetera, et cetera. So we can do this for Point of Shoals. Let's choose some other place. So let's go into the Pianca tank. And maybe we'll go up here and we'll see if we can get to Palace Bar. Now, this is a different sort of system. Okay? Again, during the early 2000s, this was a horrible place. It was difficult to find anything in Palace Bar. But it's been one of those places where there's been a lot of replenishment, and you can see. Simply look at the size of the green bars here. This is a place where you get good spat set. Of course, this is where a lot of the VMRC repletion program plants for the purposes of harvesting spat and move it out. This is not a marketplace. Well, look at this. I mean, there's really not a lot of markets in here. These are the sorts of things where you can wander through these, you know, if you finally get bored of watching the TV and you can get your kids off the internet so that you can look at something. You can look at all of these data for any one of these places that we have back up here on this larger plat. So one of the things I'd sort of encourage you to do is you think about what's going on here. So you want to choose a spot somewhere in the lower Rappahannock. Let's see what we can get here. So now we're down at North End in the lower Rappahannock, and you're seeing good stuff here. But what you also see here are these repletion activities. You see years when you leave it alone, stuff comes through. It grows. It goes from the green, which is the small, to the smalls, to the reds. This is one of those classic rotational harvests, and then you get another year when you harvest it. But in some repletion, you go back up and you go back down. So you can see a lot of the things that we talk about are a matter of following these trends up and down, and you can sort of see what's there in terms of a quantitative approach to things. It's all about numbers, and they're all on here, and Missy does this great job every year of actually writing a small summary of what's going on in this river. So if you want to do the history of Cranes Creek in the Great Wicomico, you can go in there and you can find the graph and you can find it all written out for you. The purpose, again, is communication about what we're doing so that when we get into these debates about, well, what do we think it was like 5 years ago? We can actually go back and find it, okay? So the purpose in here is as much as anything, to create an archive, but not to do it in a way that confuses people. I mean, one of the great challenges I've always had as a scientist is I love numbers. I mean, I've got a computer that's this big. In fact, I've got one at home that's got three sets of screens. My wife comes in there and looks at it, and I've got spreadsheets, and I've got graphs, and I've got everything else, and she shakes her head, puts down a drink, and walks out. You can't do that when you're trying to tell people what you're doing and why it's important to them. And so one of the sort of classical challenges that we have is, how do you put this information up here? And again, this is a different one. This is North End. It's very different to the sort of thing I showed you from Point of Shoals. Look at where the numbers are. Point of Shoals is up here at 15. North End goes up and down and up and down. And what you see in here are these shellfish repletion exercises as well. So you said, where was that planted? Will we be able to see it? We should be able to pick that up next year. If we can't pick it up, we're not doing a good job sampling. So I'm going to introduce you to this. I'm going to come back a little bit later and talk to you about one or two things on this that are a little bit worrying. I mean, they're not catastrophic, but there are things that we should think about. You know, we're always trying to sort of think ahead as to what's going on. So I'll come back to this one. But what I'd encourage you to do is just remember those six letters. If you type that into Google, it'll bring you to this. Nowhere else in the world has somebody come up with another sort of acronym that fits VOSARA. So anyway, that's where we are. People who see us out in the field often say, well, you guys go out there and, you know, how do you know how to sample in the right place? Or we don't like the data that you've got because you clearly don't know what you're doing. You're sampling in the wrong place. I've had this conversation many times. I can remember when we first started doing this in the middle 1990s, Billy Moore used to come up and berate me about this. And so one day I said, Billy, why don't you come out on the boat with me and I'll show you how you do this. And even though Billy and I didn't always see eye to eye on things, I think in the end he appreciated that he learned something from me, and I certainly learned a lot from him. So I'm going to sort of go through something where I'm going to show you some numbers. So if you don't like numbers, you can turn off in the next 5 minutes. But this is something that I think is sort of important because this is something that we do when we design a survey. Oh, God, here he goes. He's got lots of numbers up there. What is this? So somebody gives me a reef, and it covers anywhere from 10 to 100 acres. And my challenge is to tell you how many oysters there are on that reef. Okay? And so one of the things that I sort of have an interesting problem with then is, how do I sample it? And you can tell me where you think the oysters are on that reef, and I'm going to tell you that I'm going to sample it randomly. And then your response is, well, that's no good because you're going to miss all the good spots. Okay? So it comes down to sort of a simple question. All right? This is a 10-acre reef. All the oysters are in that half an acre. But actually, I don't know where that half acre is. Well, there might be another one of these and another one of these and another one of these. So I bring along this little graphic, and you can try this on your kids. Assume here that what I've got is a 10 by 10 reef. I've got 100 oysters on here in 100 cells. There's one in each cell. So we know what the answer is. The average is one per cell. Okay? So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you how I sample that, not knowing the number of oysters that there are per cell, and now I get an answer. The very first time I did this, a number of years ago, my kids were quite little, and so I told my oldest son, I said, okay, you're allowed to rearrange all these numbers, still within the 100 cells, You still have to have 100 at the end of it. You can't change the total, but you can move them around. So you can have some cells with zeros in, and you're not allowed to put them all in one cell. Okay? So what he did was, is he took that, and this is the original one that my son Matthew did nearly 18 years ago, and he rearranged all these numbers. So if you've got 10 columns and 10 rows, and these are the ones, if you add up the individual columns, and these are the ones if you add up the individual rows, and if you add them up, there's 100 in this one, and there's 100 in that one. But this one isn't distributed evenly. So my challenge now is, by sampling within these, to come up with an answer that tells me how many there are in each cell. And I'm not allowed to go and sample each cell. I've only got so much boat time to do this. So what I do is, I take this. And then what I'm going to do here is, let me go back a bit. What I've got here, if we start here, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, this is 10, this is 11, all the way through 20, this is 21 all the way through 30. So I number each one of these cells. And so this is how the numbers go. There are 5 rows of 20. Okay? There's a row of 20, a row of 20, a row of 20, and a row of 20. And what I've done here is that I've taken 100 random numbers. If you get your computer and you go into Excel and you type random numbers, it'll give you endless streams of random numbers. And I've limited them where no random number can be less than 0 and none of them can be over 100. So what it's going to do in that line of random numbers is tell me the order in which I sample the cells. Okay? So this is a line of 100 random numbers, all these ones that are here. And the ones that are in red are the numbers that come out of here. So if I go to this one and I go to cell number 77, cell number 77 is down here, and it's got 5 in it. Okay? Cell number 77 has got 5 in it. So I sample all these things in the order. And at any one point, I again tell my random number generator, tell me when to turn on counting and when to turn off counting. So what I've done here is I've sampled 5 cells randomly. I've sampled 10 cells randomly. And when I add them all up, I get an answer of 9. Here I sample another 10. I add them up and I get 16. Another 10. Another 10. And you can do this endless numbers of times. And if you look at the numbers that come out, the answers are for 10 cells, 9, 16, 5, 8, and 12. You add them all up and take the average, and lo and behold, the answer comes out to 1. So my estimate by doing this is that there's 1 in each cell. You can do this hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, and the answer comes out. One of the interesting tricks that we have when we go out sampling is the question of how few samples can we take to get this answer. And I won't bore you with all the maths of that, but the point is, there is an actual rationale as to how we do this and how we do it randomly. And we've used this over and over and over again, and it is we can repeat what we do. Now, in science, being able to repeat, it's sort of the acid test is whether or not you did it right the first place. If you do it the same, you get the same answer. So we go out and we sample these reefs, all the stuff that's covered in Vosara, and we get tons and tons of data. And every pattern tongue that comes up that covers 1 square meter, we count the total number of oysters in it, and we measure them all. We also measure all the shell that's in there and all kinds of other things. And so what comes out of that? I have hundreds of graphs like this, okay? What's this? This is an example from the rotation area in the lower part of the Rappahannock, data from 2006 through 2014. These are the various sizes. So they go from the smallest all the way up to the biggest. And these are the number that's in each group. So the blue ones are the spat. The red ones are everything else. So in this particular year, we got a good spat set. In this particular year, wasn't that good. This was better. Not so bad, really good year, really good year, really good year. And then what you do is that if you follow these through, if these are all of the young of the year in 2006, you expect them to get bigger, so you see a peak somewhere in 2007, and then 2008, and then 2009. And in fact, there are some math-fitting regimes that show how you go from here to here to here to here. then there's a few large ones left over. And you can follow them all the way through. And so what you end up doing is that you can actually create both growth curves. It gets bigger each year. And you can also take this, which is multiple years, and decompose it into the several years that are there. So if you want to start with the spat that started in 2009, I can tell you how many are left in 2008, 2009, how many are left in 2010, 11, 12, 13. They get a mortality curve as well. This is sort of an example, and I use the Maryland data set because I've been helping the people at Maryland DNR do the same sorts of things. This was my first shot with the Maryland data, and it was so nice, I never repeated it. But the point here is, again, if you take the Maryland interval data, it's the same thing, numbers of animals, sizes. This is a big spat set. This one here grew to this one, then grew through here, and this was where it was essentially 3 years out, and it was about 75 millimeters, which is about 3 inches, and it made 4 inches by the time it got to the fifth year. So you can create lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of this data. I have computers full of it. But this is the sort of stuff that we use when we condense it to put it onto that Vocera site. So if you want to know how well stuff is growing, how well it's dying, you can take all of that out of this information. So I take all of this information, and there's some other things that we do with it as well. And I promise you this is almost the last slide that's got lots of graphs on it. Why am I interested in this? I can create a growth curve. So at 1 year old, they're about 45 millimeters. At 2 year old, they're about 60. 3 year olds, they're a little bit over 3 inches at about 80. 4 year olds, they're up here almost at 100 millimeters. They're almost 4 inches. This one is actually based on 67,000 oysters from the Pianca tank collected over a 14-year period. I'm also interested in the relationship between the length and the shell, and the length and all other kinds of things. And why am I interested in this shell thing? Why am I so obsessed with it? It's crucial to the way you manage things. I'm preaching to the converted. You know this. But one of the things that's sort of intriguing when you do this is, so we've got all this shell data, and we know where all the shell's coming from, and we know where it's going to. And our biggest problem is that what we're trying to do is to maintain a shell base. This one in the middle. We know there's live oysters, and over time they either harvest them or they die. We put shell there, and some of it's buried, and some of it just degrades, it rots, it goes away, it dissolves, it does all kinds of things. And really what we're trying to do in terms of replenishment, to go back to, right to the things that Andrew talked about, is that we're trying to maintain this. And we all know that over time, if we don't do anything with this, it goes away. Now, hang on, that isn't right. Oysters have been around for about 50 million years. Nobody was doing repletion 20, 30, 40 million years ago. A lot of this has to do with the fact that oysters here, first of all, they grow in a slightly different form to fossil ones. Fossil ones tend to grow like this, long, thin, and they have thick shells. That's important. Thick shells dissolve much slower. A lot of the stuff that we see growing today doesn't necessarily have that thickness in its shell, and so it tends to dissolve faster. When it dissolves faster, it goes away faster, so you have to keep replenishing it faster. And so you get yourself into this race, trying to sort of maintain that shell base there. Almost the last graph. What's the importance of this? This is actually shell per unit meter. This is actually in grams. Just think of it as a relative number. In the Great Wicomico from 2006 through 2018. So the shell base sort of goes up and down over time. Total amount of shell that's out there. And most of the shell, though, is here. It's in the two-year-old oysters. Only a little bit's in the 1 year, and only a little bit's in the 3 years, in part because we harvest some of it, but also because of mortality. The reason why I show you this, wouldn't it be nice if, in fact, I had 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 year olds here, and so the loss of any 1 year class wouldn't necessarily worry us? Again, I can go through every one of those reefs that's on the Vocera site. We could be here until 3 o'clock in the morning, and you'd all be asleep, and I'd be running through yet more of them. And one of the great challenges that we have in these systems is about 50% of the shell typically resides in those just submarket sizes. They are really critical. We've got to treat those well and get them through to market, both in order for you to catch them, but also to leave some there as well. That's why we get obsessed about this whole idea of shell. Now, I could show you something like this, which is a series of calculations for all of the places where we do these surveys. There are about 1,800 stations a year in here over a period of 10 years. And this is the amount of sort of bushels per area. So, you know, there's about 200,000 bushels in the Great Wicomico, a little bit less, you know, in the Piankatank, some of these areas. And the nice things about these graphs over this period, now this is post-2006. This is on the ascendancy after the diseases. Okay? The nice thing about these is that generally they're pretty stable. And certainly the work that's been done with replenishment in the York Mobjack, you see this coming from not too good to. There was a large amount of repletion work here, and it's built and it's been pretty stable. There was some pretty good efforts made in the Piankatank after this period when it was low, and it's brought it back. The thing I like to sort of look at when I look at these trends over a long period of time is that they're relatively stable. It's not getting a lot worse. It's not getting a lot better, but the point is we can run an industry on this. But always the caveat in the midst of this is, if a lot of your shell is all sitting in one size or one year class of oysters, if you lose a year class or you have two bad years of recruitment, you get yourself into trouble really quickly. You already know that, but the point is that we can put numbers in it, and then the difficult thing for you is for Andrew to stand in front of you and say, we've got 6,000 acres that we need to put shell back on. We've got enough for three. Which are they going to be? And the point is that when we get into this debate about how fast we should put this stuff back and where it's going to stay and where it's going to do the best, we have a fairly solid arithmetic background for telling you why we think you should put this much here. Now, you guys have sort of learned this in some instances, multiple generations of expertise here. But we can do this mathematically and tell you where we think it's going to go, whether it's up, down, or indifferent. And one of the things that I've been trying to do with this, because it's an enormously complicated data set, but this year I will stand here and I will say it publicly, so I have to do it. Always one of the challenges in getting this data done, because we do these surveys in the fall, is getting something into the hands of the commissioner so that when the commissioner goes to the General Assembly the following January, he can put something on the table and say, this is what we need. The way in which we've always done this, the problem is that the timing of the survey and the data analysis, often we don't get our reports done until February, and at that point in time, you're a little bit behind the eight ball. The people who are sitting behind me have done an enormous amount of work in the last couple of years of getting this from clipboards and paper and whatever to digital measuring systems, which we can put the information into these things more or less as they come off the boat. And we can generate this sort of information so that hopefully by the time we all go home for Christmas, I have a document that I can give to the commissioner so that on the first day of the General Assembly meeting, I can go in and tell him, this is what came through in terms of dollars last year. This is where the money was spent in terms of shell. This is what comes out of it. This is what's in the survey. And this is the prospect for the next year. And then, sir, or madam, whichever the case may be, you go and tell the story to the General Assembly and tell them how good it will be if they will continue to put money into this and to continue to support. So again, it's a matter of storytelling. As a scientist, I love data sets. That's no good. What I need to do is to sort of be able to distill these things down so that we get them to tools that the commissioner can use, and I'm sure the commissioner sort of engages you to go for a walk around the General Assembly as well and tell them what's happening again. So there's a lot of underlying math in this. It's not there to threaten you. It's to be able to provide a truly scientifically defensible approach to this. It's not. It's absolutely not decrying the work that you guys do. The important point is that you come in with the observations and I can come in with the numbers and we agree. That's a powerful set of tools, okay? Having said that, let me just go back to this. Because these are a couple of trends that when you look at this stuff, if you look at it long enough, you can either find something interesting or send yourself to sleep. Depends which one you want to do. If we go out here into the Burwell Bay area, One of the things that has both been marvelous and is starting to be, I think, a little bit worrisome as we now go sort of into the future years. We've had a wonderful seed industry here. Let's see if we can get this reef to light up. What am I doing here, Missy? There we go. This is Point of Shoals. And I said, don't panic about this yet. But this is one of the places where we take a lot of seed. When we take a lot of seed, we actually take a lot of shell. And so, I mean, if you do the simple math about how much seed you move, you take a bushel. If you're good, you get 3 bushels back. You look at the cost on the front end, you look at the return on the back end. This is good stuff. However, this is the source. And one of the things that we have to be careful of here is that we don't shoot ourselves in the foot by depleting the underlying shell. One of the things that we have talked about in terms of as we continue to develop our survey is whether or not, or in some cases how, we should focus on some of these seed reefs to try to get a better handle on how the shell base is going up and down. I mean, this is one of those golden goose that you really have to take care of. And so when we start thinking about our repletion programs, we also need to start thinking about our seed programs and some of the things that we need to do to maintain those best seed reefs. Because these are a large part of our income, and they're something that worked really well. So we see this here on Point of Shoal. If we go to some of these other sites out here and across over here where there's seed planting as well, you see the same sorts of things. So one of the things I'd like to encourage you to do, when you get a chance, you've got 20 minutes to sit at a computer, is to sit and look at this site. Because as we go through the summer in terms of trying to decide where you want to make this coming year's activity, where you want to focus it. Now, a lot of you know, you're out there, every working day you have a good idea, but some of these other data sets like that, I'd like you to go and look at them. And what I'd like when we sort of next get together and we start talking about replenishments and seed is some feedback on these ideas, because what I've just done is I tell you that I could actually develop a scenario where I could ruin your seed fishery really quickly if we don't take care of these particular areas, and they're relatively small, that are important to the seed fishery. The data's up here, and I sort of tend to look at the numbers. That's what I do. You guys go out there, and you look at what's on the bottom. That's what you do. What we need to have is a conversation about some of those areas that are not critical at the moment, but we need to make sure that we don't make a mess of them. I mean, one of the things that I always like to point out, and it's not that... We had a conversation 12 years ago about rotational harvest. We didn't always agree, but we came to a protocol and it worked. We've not messed with it. It does work. This is one of those things where I think we need to have a talk about what we want to do about seed harvest areas and what we consider are critical functions in it and how we're going to maintain them. I'd hate to see us make a mess of it. We've shown that we can really do good things with such things as rotational harvest. I think this is one thing that's not bad yet, but we ought to, looking at those trends, we ought to have a look at it. So when we get back to the repletion program, we'll do that. Rather than monopolize the rest of the time, I encourage you to go have a look at it. You've all got my phone number. If you haven't, Andrew will give it to you. I can give it to you. You can find me on the VIMS website. I'm always happy to talk about this stuff. I'm happy to come back and talk to this group, or I'm happy to talk to any of you individually. Thank you,
Mayor. Dr. Mann, we sure do appreciate everything you've done for us over the years.
Roger.
Roger, okay. But before we get done with your presentation right here, I was wondering if anybody had any questions.
Sure.
My name is Beverly Ledford, and I'm a newbie. So
I was 30 years ago as well.
Mm-hmm. On this committee, not necessarily on the earth. I'm fascinated by your presentation, and I'd like to hear a little bit more, even if it's just a gut feeling from you, about this issue of fossil shell versus house shell, or the thickness of the shell and the reason that the shell deteriorates so much more quickly, in terms of 3 or 4 different things that come to my mind, such as warming, acidity, disease.
Okay, let's try and get that in under 20 minutes.
Okay.
Fossil shell versus house shell. If you think about the sort of, Edward Charles Darwin answered this question. You go back and answer, what have oysters been settling on for the last 60 million years? And it's the equivalent of the dead shells of recently died animals or on live animals. So that tells you that it's more or less the equivalent of house shell rather than dead shell. I mean, we've used fossil shell productively. Fossil shell is an interesting stuff in that once you bury it and then exhume it, the chemistry of the surface of the shell changes completely. We are still learning about all of that microchemistry. It can serve as a good substrate. I don't think that it's necessarily any better or any worse. I think you could probably have more of a difference in the way in which you plant it than the original stuff itself. And so I think the critical debate when you're doing that is, how are you going to plant it, and are you going to plant it productively? All right, let's move on to the next one. Does it degrade and disappear at the same or different rates? The fact that you can go proverbially dig holes in oyster reefs and find shell underneath that's thousands upon thousands upon thousands of years old. I have a bucket of oysters that we were measuring in my lab this week that came actually out of a clam dredge that was operating in about 120 feet of water south of Shinnecock. These oysters are probably on the order of 50,000 years old. All the bottom valves are intact under the top ones. Top ones are thinner than these old. But even then, they're much thicker. They're also completely different shape. They're often much older than being 10 plus years old. Why are they still here? They've been buried. The chemistry changes once they get buried down in there. Once they're actually up in the water column, even if it's only by this much, there's a whole raft of things that happen to make shells disappear and dissolve. If there was not, I could walk out of Bims and walk all the way across the York River on shell and get to sort of have lunch on the other side without getting my feet wet. Shells are actually designed to dissolve and pass away, and they're designed to do that. Because one of the things, I mean, shells are like tons. The other neat thing, though, is that they produce these layers in the chemistry of the water that actually encourages the small oysters to set. So the idea of oyster shell going away actually has a beneficial component to it. There's a chemical component. There's actually a structural component. You know, I grew up on the other side of the Atlantic, and where I went to graduate school in North Wales, we had 5 meters of tide. We had rocky intertidal. And all kinds of things. I came to this part of the world and spent the first 5 years scratching my head trying to work out how things work. If you think about all of the mid-latitudes of the Earth, okay, from about Cape Cod south all the way to central Brazil, and you draw lines all the way around the Earth and you look at all of the estuaries, all of the giant river estuaries, and you ask yourself, what in those river estuaries is hard substrate for things like oysters? Now, there's roofs on mangrove reefs, but there's no coral. I mean, oysters are extraordinary organisms in that they've essentially occupied this band around the center of the Earth in the estuaries, and they form the only substantial hard substrate. They form the only things that form three-dimensional structure. Without them, the entire sort of structure of fish communities and everything else over one half of the Earth's surface in terms of estuaries wouldn't be the same. So part of this is the structure. But also those structures are designed to dissolve. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to get into the Chesapeake Bay. So, when you look at an oyster shell, it's something that grows, but it's also designed to dissolve. It's also designed, actually, to fall apart. If you look at oyster shells, you can look at the number of things that bore holes in them and stick on them, which, of course, is a real nuisance if you're trying to salinize that shell. There are lots of organisms that, over the last 60 million years, have thought this is a pretty neat place to live. So they've actually taken advantage of it as well. So the life of an oyster shell when it's above the sediment water interface and when it's below, completely different. They serve completely different biological, chemical, and geological purposes. So your question is actually something that people have written books about. Now if you get to the next debate about acidification, Yeah, acidification is a challenge. You drop oyster shell into acid and it dissolves. If you think about estuaries, all the water that's out to sea is buffered. Its acidity doesn't change very much. All the water that's coming down off the watershed can actually be quite acid depending upon where it comes from. And in the middle you get this giant mixing zone where the tides go in and out. And the acidity goes up and down seasonally. It goes up and down with the tides. It goes up and down with all kinds of things. Again, oysters are sort of unusual because what they've done is that they've moved into this area. They've built these structures. And they can actually lay down shell quite quickly in order to combat this. On the other hand, they lay down shells for another reason. If you and I would go and run up the stairs around here, assuming there are stairs, a couple of dozen times, we'd all be puffing and panting. And why is that? It's because we've got lactic acid in our muscles. We don't respire properly. And then at the end of it, what we have to do is neutralize all that acid. Oysters do exactly the same thing. Oysters breathe reasonably well, but they also have a part of their metabolism that produces acid. And so essentially the way in which they neutralize that is by dissolving their own shell. Their shells serve multiple purposes. So your question about, you know, what is sort of the long-term, all the facets of this thing? There are dozens of them. And we focus on two or three parts of that. We try to control the rest of it the best we can, but a lot of the variability that goes into these systems is driven by all of these other things that have resulted over evolutionary time that we can't control.
Thank you.
All right, I should let Ryan get up, otherwise it'll be midnight. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see where I am. Well, thanks very much for giving me the opportunity to come in and talk to you. I'm really pleased to be here. Typically when I am invited to come talk to somebody as the pathologist, people sort of don't feel like it's going to be good news, or you know, they'll shudder, or like, oh God, what's he going to say? Hopefully, though, I think you'll maybe get the point after this presentation that really where we are with oyster diseases today is probably not anywhere near as bad a place as we were a few years ago, and that I think we have some promise for a better future with regard to our oyster's interaction with these pathogens if we manage it all properly. So let me provide some introduction to what we're talking about here in terms of the pathogens. So Prickinsis marinus and Haplosporidium nelsoni, this is MSX and Dermo, as you probably know them. Dermo is the top image that I have here, and we see there's a few Prickinsis cells. I assume you can all see the cursor. These are some dividing cells up here. This is so Dermo is probably a native pathogen, probably endemic to the Chesapeake Bay region, always here, just a native pathogen infecting oyster populations, you know, from the very beginning, probably. It was first found the first time somebody looked for it in the late 1940s. It's an obligate parasite of oysters. It only infects oysters. It has to infect oysters. And it is directly transmissible among those oysters in a population. So it will spread from one oyster to another oyster on a reef, you know, in a cage, and so on. MSX, the bottom image. So these are this is a section, a microscopic image of oyster gill, and these pink areas that we see around, sort of toward the outside of the gill, are the MSX or Haplosporidium nelsoni cells. So this is the pathogen that caused the problems beginning in 1959 when it emerged in Chesapeake Bay. This is an introduced pathogen that came over at some time prior to that from Asia. We have no idea how it got here, but it's not going away. So it emerged in 1959. It's been present ever since.
Unlike Prickensis, it's not directly transmissible from oyster to oyster. So we sort of struggle a bit with MSX in that we fully understand what all the possible levers are to manage this parasite, because it's lurking somewhere else in the environment outside of the oysters, and we've never been able to fully resolve where that is. Probably some small worm or copepod or something that's crawling around on oyster reefs. But we don't know. Both of these pathogens are active. MSX will not tolerate salinities below about 10. So anywhere where the salinities will be below 10 for any length of time might see MSX purged entirely from those oyster reefs. It's most active above 10 to 12 parts per thousand. So up to full-strength seawater, it's fully pathogenic in oyster populations. Dermo, Prickensis, sort of shares a similar profile with regard to salinities, except that at those low salinities, it is not going to be totally knocked out of these oyster reefs or oyster populations. It will be able to withstand those lower salinities for some length of time until the salinities come back up so that it could transmit itself well. And both are distributed very broadly in the Chesapeake Bay region based on those salinity patterns. We have been studying oyster diseases in the lab that I presently run for a long time. Gene Burrison was my predecessor from the 1980s up until about 7 or 8 years ago. Jay Andrews really started focusing on oyster diseases around 1949 at VIMS. So we've been working on surveys in collaboration with VMRC and with colleagues such as Roger Mann for over all that period. We have a number of different elements to our monitoring program to provide the data to inform our picture of oyster diseases in Virginia. We have a fall survey, which we do in collaboration with Roger and Missy and with the Marine Resources Commission, where we obtain samples from 30 Virginia oyster reefs. This is every October. And we look at 25 market-sized oysters, basically, from every one of those reefs. So we've done that every October, and the survey in its present form dates back to the late 1980s. We have a James quarterly survey, which basically extends fall survey sampling for wreck shoal, point of shoal, horsehead, and deep water shoal from October into January, April, and July as well. So we get quarterly coverage of the year. For the last 3 or 4 years, we've been doing a seaside quarterly survey, also January, April, July, and October for two seaside reefs, one out of Oyster and one in Watch Creek Channel. And we have a spring import sentinel deployment program. So this, in this case, we take for the spring imports, we collect oysters, and we just did this a couple weeks ago, from the upper part of the Rappahannock, typically Ross Rock, it was Bowlers this year, and we bring them to the York River right at VIMS every around May 1st, and we sample them monthly over the course of the next 6 months, basically to get an indication on an annual basis of the relative intensity of the disease outbreaks by MSX and Dermo and the timing. So it gives us a good indicator of, is this a bad year or not so bad a year with regard to those diseases. And the spring imports basically have been going on every year since 1960. So in terms of sort of the data and the picture, we might look most conventionally at what does oyster disease look like today in the Chesapeake Bay region? And basically we're talking about, is this a good year, with regard to oyster health, or a bad year? And mostly that comes down to weather. Whether this has been, a rainy few months with a lot of water coming down the watershed, depressing salinities, creating conditions that are less favorable for the oysters, or has it been a dry period where the salinities are able to start creeping up, which create conditions that are more favorable for the oyster diseases. So it has a lot to do with salinity, and it also has something to do with temperature. A very mild winter will mean that there's basically more, pathogen fuel for the fire the next summer. Really cold winters, on the other hand, will tend to knock back the diseases somewhat. So temperature has a role in this too. So where are we with regard to this year and recent years with regard to disease in the system? And so what I've done here, just to try to distill the story down to a single dermo disease figure, this is the weighted prevalence of Prickensis since from 1989 all the way through 2018 in fall survey data. So this is an average, the mean weighted prevalence across all of the Virginia oyster reefs that we study. And weighted prevalence, that's a number that, you know, I know it's not going to mean anything necessarily to you on its face. The Perkinsus prevalence is typically above 80% everywhere except in the low salinities. So prevalence of Perkinsus is very high. The weighted prevalence data that I'm presenting on the graph here basically integrates prevalence and intensities. So not only how many oysters are infected, but how heavy are those infections in the bodies of the oysters. So a higher number on this graph is a higher combination of prevalence and very intense, very serious infections. So what we see just looking sort of in overall terms, for example, we had a few years from 1999 to 2002 that were very intense with regard to the oyster diseases. In general, the more recent period from 2004 or so on is a little bit higher than the period before that 1999 to 2002 period. But all the way over at the right where we are today, 2018 is the last data point, basically is below average in terms of Perkinsus in the Virginia part of Chesapeake Bay, you know, fairly well below average, and actually almost, you know, in sort of the low region for the overall time period, almost in the lowest 25% of all observations. So where we are with regard to dermo today is pretty low by historical Virginia standards. And really it has a lot to do with where we've been in recent months with regard to rainfall in the watershed. And what I've got on the top graph here, and I sort of just pasted this in and made sure that the x-axis with regard to the years, 1989 to 2018, matched. But this is the stream flow anomaly in the James River from 1989 to the present. And basically what the numbers are you're looking at, a bar that's above the graph, a bar sort of equivalent to 100, this is twice the normal stream flow in the James River. Stream flows of 100% above what is normal. You know, 200, that's 200% of the normal stream flow. So what we can see in the recent months, all the way over to the right of the graph, is that in recent months, we've been way above normal in terms of water coming down the James. And we know in the Potomac, the Susquehanna, the other rivers that are significant for the Chesapeake, the story's basically been the same. But we can look sort of in big picture terms and see a trend in Perkinsus levels that roughly correspond to what we're seeing in that upper graph in terms of the stream flows. We had that 1999 to 2002 peak, that the highest part of the Perkinsus graph, which my cursor is kind of hard to see against the white background for you, I know. That corresponds to an extended period from 1999 to 2002 where all of those bars were below the zero level in the graph. This was very low stream flows, high salinities, high dermo disease. We had in the 2003-2004 period, we reached very low levels of dermo again because we had very high levels of river flow in 2003 and 2004. We had generally low river flows in around 2006-2007, and dermo levels, Perkinsus levels, generally creeping upward into about 2010 or so. And then in the recent period, we've generally been on a decline as we've reached a period where, you know, we have some months that are a little bit wetter, some months that are a little bit drier, generally a more normal period up until the last year or so that have been very, very wet. So we have a long-term trend basically that has us at right now relatively low levels of Perkinsus based on simply like weather patterns over recent years. Any questions on that so far?
Fine. What part does disease resistance play?
I'm going to get into that.
Okay, you're going that direction.
Yeah, I'll get into that. So maybe if you could hold that question and see if I answer it with my slides at the back end. But that is going to be part of the story.
Yeah. How about pathology as it relates to fresh water?
That's a problem. And, we know that
do you have any charts relevant to that?
I do not in my presentation. I know that VMRC has some nice figures on where the mortality has been.
That's the big issue right now for a lot of places.
Yeah,
up here.
Yeah.
But no, nothing yet.
I don't have any figures that relate to that, but I know that there's some data here that speak to that.
Yeah, Ryan, in the Rappahannock last year, we had a lot of dead loss in deep water, mostly over 20 feet.
Yeah.
Was that disease-related?
That was probably Hepatosporidium nelsoni, yeah. We had, that was, I'll talk about MSX next, but we had, and MSX has not been as much of a problem in recent years as it has been before, but there are, you know, specific places and times where we see MSX sort of uptick a little bit and cause a bit of mortality. And the mouth of the Rappahannock area, you know, off the Pianca Tank, this was an area in recent years we've seen sort of a little bit of an uptick in MSX. Nothing extraordinary by historical standards, but definitely something of an outbreak in those areas.
So you don't attribute it to salinity or to oxygen depletion?
No. I you know, the data that we have suggests that that's probably MSX. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So let me, a little bit more on present status of Dermo. And this is just some remarks that basically, in verbal terms, present where we were with regards to the 2018. The very bottom point I make, you know, we're in terms of where we are now, we've been below the long-term average for all of these sites in 2018, except for Hog House Rock and the Rappahannock, which was just a little bit above average. Everywhere else below average in terms of Dermo impact, Dermo levels. In the James River, we were in the low zone, basically in the bottom 25% of historical of observations relative to the historical trend. So we were low at 6 of 7 reefs, record lows at Horsehead and Point of Shoal. We were in the normal zone, sort of the middle zone, kind of average at Nansemond. York and Mobjack, low at Toastake and Aberdeen, normal at Pulse Bar and Bell Rock. The Pianca Tank was low in the low zone for all three sites that we sampled. And the Rappahannock, low at 6 of 9 reefs, normal only at Muratico, Hog House, and Middle Ground. Great Wicomico, low at Haney and Fleet, normal at Whaley's and Crean's. And again, below the long-term average everywhere but Hog House Rock. So generally, with regard to the long-term trend, we've been lower than we have been with regard to Dermo disease.
What? That information you got over here about Horsehead is my experience over in June and July. Everything over there died from that fresh water.
Fresh water, yeah.
So you don't have any live oysters to even see.
Well, we had some live oysters at Horsehead that, you know, that were provided in the fall, but mortality, you know, is probably continuing now. And in fact, we were out at Bowlers just a couple of weeks ago. You know, we were able to sample enough oysters at Bowlers to get oysters for our spring imports deployment at the Bins Beach. I was guessing, you know, that we're probably something like between 30 and 50% mortality based on the boxes that were coming on board. But a number of the oysters that we did pathology on were in really bad shape too, suggesting kind of the lingering effects of that low salinity and a continuing pulse of mortality that was probably going to continue for at least a little bit longer, based on the low salinity stress and the warming temperatures basically creating metabolic demands where these animals needed to kind of wake up from the wintertime and they were in bad shape and hardly, you know, not going to be able to do that very well.
So wasn't the salinity below 10?
Salinity was below 10, so it was, I mean, low enough that it wasn't going to be the parasites killing the oysters.
Well,
but Dermo
is what you're talking about there, and that's not supposed to be doing anything below 10, right?
And Dermo wasn't causing any mortality.
Oh.
I mean, it's there. It's going to be there,
okay.
But it's just not going to be causing disease.
So it will survive below 10.
Dermo will survive below 10.
It won't affect the oysters.
It's not going to kill anything below 10.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Below 10, you're getting into the salinity issues. Yeah.
What salinity can an oyster stand?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, certainly below 5. I mean, it's going to do better at low salinities in the winter than it is going to be in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of absolute lows.
That question was asked to us 2 years ago by the people over at Surrey Nuclear Power Station because they now regularly get oysters growing in their cooling system.
Oh, yeah.
Don't tell anybody about that. It'll cause panic.
Uh-huh.
We went back and looked at some work that Jay Andrews did about 40 years ago, and he said that maybe about 3 parts per 1,000, there's a big salinity temperature interaction here. Mm-hmm. If you think about where Surrey is, it's, you know, slightly upstream and on the opposite side to deep water light. Once you get up to about 28 degrees C and down to about 2 parts per 1,000, they start to go pretty quickly. You only have to drop the temperature a little bit, and they're really quite tolerant. So it's very sharp sort of edge there. The other thing that was interesting was that the data from the study that Melissa and I did suggests that those animals are a good deal more low salinity tolerant now than they were back in Jay Andrews' day. Darwin tells us that that's what should happen anyway if they keep getting exposed. Mm-hmm. So they're stressed. They don't necessarily die. They're in terrible shape, and whether or not they ever come back to anything decent once they've been down at 2,000 or 3,000 mm-hmm. for any period of time is another debate. But you don't necessarily see the massive catastrophic mortalities mm-hmm. that you would. What really clobbers them is when you get complete freshets, as John was talking about. Mm-hmm. Once you get that, then they all tend to go at the same time.
Yeah. How about larvae?
Well, larvae are both dumb and smart. Larvae really can't control very much where they swim upstream and downstream. They can control where they are in the water column. And so, you know, if the water's going out this way and there's fresh water behind it, they're going out. As they get bigger, they tend to sink a little bit. And if it's more saline, they might come back in again. But I wouldn't say that your biggest salinity effects are on larvae. They're on the ones that, you know, you can't move.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So this next graph I still have the James River river flow anomalies graph at the top here, but this is Haplospirema nelsoni, or MSX, that's on the bottom graph now. And this is prevalence. So this is, you know, in percentage terms. So, you know, in 100 oysters, how many have MSX? And we see from 1989 all the way through to 2018 is the trend. And generally, we've been lower than in the past with regard to MSX in Virginia. This is fall data, which isn't the best time of year to pick up MSX. The recent mortalities, like at the Deep Rock area, so this was probably, you know, spring into late summer. I mean, we got some samples from the BMRC around that time, and that's when we saw MSX, spring, early summer, May, June. So we know that if we look earlier in the year, we might see higher prevalences, and we know that you know, here and there, any given year, there might be a higher level of MSX. Sometimes it's on the lower bayside eastern shore. Sometimes it's off the, you know, the mouth of the Rappahannock. Sometimes it's in New York. And the dynamics of that we really don't fully understand. That probably relates more to the local presence of whatever the intermediate host is for MSX, you know, that worm or copepod or whatever it is that's carrying the parasite. You know, these benthic organisms are you know, waxing and waning in terms of their abundance and distributions. That's probably controlling the local dynamics with regard to MSX to an extent that we don't really appreciate. But so with regard to MSX in general, this is not the pathogen today that it was in earlier years. And this gets us into sort of the other area of the talk that I wanted to get into. And so, you know, we talked about weather sort of shaping, like, all right, what do the oyster diseases look like now? But a lot of what we're doing is trying to sort of take a longer view and think about the evolutionary ecology of these interactions. How are these interactions changing over time? You know, the interaction of the oyster, Crassata virginica, with MSX, the oyster with Dermo, the two parasites interacting with each other, all of this is happening. The parasites are competing for real estate inside of individual oysters. Where is all of this going over time? Because we know that these parasites are very pathogenic, you know, causing mortality historically that exceeded, you know, 80 or 90% in Chesapeake Bay oyster populations. This is not a gentle pressure on these oyster populations. Is it possible we're seeing any level of resistance response on the part of the oysters after years and years of disease exposure? And that's what we've been looking for. And in particular, you know, we've looked at graphs like this, and you saw this figure in another way earlier today. You know, we've seen this long decline in oyster abundance in the region. This is numbers of bushels harvested, public reefs, private leases over the years. We know that oysters are increasing in abundance in the system in more recent years. And, well, part of the story is that we're growing a lot more oysters in aquaculture than we had been. And that's the red in this increasing, you know, right part of the graph. But what we have to acknowledge is that the red bars are increasing too. So this is the public harvests, you know, the public harvests off the public reefs, which reflect increasing oyster abundance on the public reefs in recent years. Certainly relative to that period in the 1990s when we were, you know, in basically you know, considering moratorium on the harvests. So, of course, you know, oyster restoration gets a lot of attention. This is a quote from Peyton Robertson, you know, the collective impact of effort by agencies, nonprofits, and academic partners in Maryland and Virginia, including science, planning, implementation, and monitoring is significant. And there's a wide appreciation that, that all of this effort going into, you know, oyster restoration activities and all of that is really being very impactful with regard to improving the situation with regard to the oyster resource in the region. And of course, you know, finally, this recognition that we've settled on the right strategy after all this time. This is a quote from Allison Colden. You know, small scale reef restoration projects in the past haven't made much of a dent in the Bay's historically low oyster population. The large scale restoration projects that we're pursuing now are sort of a change in the way things used to be. This is the first time we're seeing benefits compared with those previous projects that never panned out. So we're, you know, we've had sort of an epiphany of how we're doing restoration in these systems. And this figure here sort of highlights where these mega projects are. I mean, a lot of work in the Lynn Haven, the Elizabeth River area, Piankatank, Great Wicomico, Harris Creek is getting a lot of attention in up in Maryland. And so this is where the mega projects are. This is where we're realizing, you know, how to do oyster restoration and managing these populations. And I don't really agree with any of that because I look at data like Missy and Roger are generating, and I just, you know, this is data. This is their data. Great Wicomico, Rappahannock, Piankatank, York River, James River. You can see where these mega projects are. You know, there's just a handful of them in a few different places in the Bay where there's a tremendous investment at a very local scale in oyster, you know, shell planting and all of that. When we look at the scale of the recovery of the oyster resource, we see that it's over the entire scale of the Bay. I mean, not every reef is doing well, but by and large, the geography of the increase in oyster abundance, of the improvement of the oyster resource, is way out of scale of where those mega projects are, which really raises questions about the assumptions underlying the value of those mega projects. And really where we are in terms of thinking about disease and thinking about these interactions of the oyster populations with diseases is wondering whether the oyster itself is bringing something to the table in terms of these interactions. Is the oyster itself doing better than it had been with regard to its interactions with MSX and Dermo? And there's been a lot of, you know, an unwillingness to acknowledge that any of this is even possible. You know, this is Don Merritt from Maryland. You know, until I see a dermo-proof oyster, I don't want to hear about disease resistance. And that's a common refrain. But, you know, the reality is that oyster mortality is way below what it was during the historical outbreaks caused by MSX and dermo. It's far below what it was in the late 90s and the early 2000s. And Roger and Missy, you know, have very clear data in all of their annual monitoring that speaks to that. And this is just some of our data that we had a summer high school student in the lab, and we were just out just to give them something to do. We went out and did some box counts in the summertime. You know, Page Rock and Aberdeen and New York, Parrot Drumming and Broad in the Rap, Rexall and Deepwater in the James, and you know, the highest mortality in terms of box counts, so integrating over perhaps a year of mortality, was something like 30%. This is way below, you know, the 70 or 80 or 90% that was observed during the early years of these disease outbreaks. But let's look a little more closely at what's going on in terms of the actual interactions. And this is, you know, a single slide capturing sort of the essence of the MSX story. You know, we feel, you know, very confident that there has been a response in terms of resistance to MSX in oyster populations. And let me walk you through what we're looking at in this particular graph. In the green, sort of the upper part, the upper trend, that is the maximum annual MSX prevalence that we register in the Sentinel oysters, our spring imports, on the VIMS beach. So these are the disease-free upper Rappahannock oysters that are planted at VIMS, where we look at the relative timing and intensity of those diseases. That's MSX in those sentinels. The blue at the bottom, that is wild wreck shoal oysters. So this is the maximum MSX prevalence annually in the wreck shoal oysters. And what we see overall is, you know, in terms of the spring imports, the sentinels in green, generally an increasing trend from 1960 through into the recent period, with a very recent decline in recent years, but generally an increasing trend over the period. In the blue, we see the initial presence of MSX at Wreck Shoal in 1960 and 61 during the initial outbreak. We see the disappearance, through the 1960s and 1970s of MSX from Wreck Shoal and in the lower James, probably because the salinities were so low as to be inhospitable to the parasite in the James through that period. Then in the middle part of the graph, you can see that those two trends basically mirror each other very closely. So that was the 1980s. That was a time of drought. The salinities were up. MSX was able to recolonize Wreck Shoal, and Wreck Shoal oysters were getting slammed by MSX. And basically, they were functioning the exact same way as the green trend, the naive sentinel oysters that had never seen any MSX in that time period from the late 1980s into the early 1990s. The spring import sentinels, which are naive and susceptible, they were basically equivalently susceptible to the Wreck Shoal oysters. But after about 1993, those two trends went in opposite directions. What that reveals is that the Wreck Shoal oysters at that time started becoming more resistant. You know, the survivors were reproducing, they were living longer, they were producing, you know, progeny that were also resistant, and the whole thing just sort of took off. And we published this work in 2011, bringing in, you know, a bunch of data from all over our, you know, all over our monitoring program, basically suggesting that, well, this wasn't just a Wreck Shoal thing. This is a Virginia oyster population thing, that the oyster populations are responding to this, these decades of MSX pressure by basically becoming much more resistant to the parasite than they had been. And that's where we are today with regard to MSX. You know, the parasite's not going anywhere. It's still surviving in the environment in oyster populations at a low level, in whatever that little benthic organism is that's crawling around on oyster reefs with the parasite. It causes a little bit of mortality at times, you know, that may reach 20 or 30% in the worst years, but generally it's probably not causing more than 10 or 15% mortality in the sort of the hot zone areas of higher salinity that are good for MSX.
Why?
Yep.
Ask one question.
Yep.
And I'm listening to this intently because it's important, obviously, to the industry, but what are the trends in salinity? I mean, are we having more fluctuations in salinity now than we used to have? I mean, back in, well, 98, I guess it was, I'm trying to remember the years, but it was 1999 and 2002 were extremely dry years.
Extremely dry years, yeah.
But what are you all seeing as far as, are we having more torrential rainfalls than we used to have and more salinity fluctuations, or is it the same trend we've had over years, just the salinity goes down over a period of years and it comes back up over a period of years?
Well, I think there's sort of, I think, an underlying creep upward in salinities because the sea level's rising and the salt wedge is pushing further up the system. But overlaid on that would be whatever the precipitation trends in is. Are we getting more of those storms, you know, more of the intense storms? And
we've seen, I mean, remember back to the early 70s when we had Agnes in 72, I think.
Yep.
It was.
Yep.
There seemed to be a period of years after that where the salinity realm was lower.
Right, right.
For, I don't remember how many years. I know by the 80s it was back up again.
Yeah.
But what data do you have on that? Do you have data back for a number of years so that you can predict or try to predict what the next year or two or three might bring in salinity in the Chesapeake Bay?
Yeah. Well, we have plenty of data going back in the historical past. The question is, you know, what do we have in terms of sort of modeling forecasts looking ahead? Mm-hmm. And that's a question I don't have a specific answer to that, but I know we've got between VIM scientists and ODU scientists NOAA working in the Bay region. I mean, there's a lot of people that are looking at that and trying to model moving ahead. What's the physical environment going to look like in terms of temperature, salinity, dissolved oxygen, and all of that? So that's something. I mean, I could look into that and get back to.
One of the great challenges in this lake is, Ryan's absolutely right, one of the great challenges in this is if you want to go out 5 or 6 or 10 years, what do you expect? We have through supercomputing these climate change models. Now again, we need to separate weather, which is what happens over the next few weeks, with climate, which is what happens over a long time. I'm sure many of you here will remember, if you think back through your lifetimes, periods of wet summers and dry summers, and what you're seeing at the moment is also warmer winters. Okay, so you suggest just from these observations that maybe there's some cyclic behavior in this. If we look at the large climate change models, which work on really large scales, and they try to predict how large the ice caps are going to be and all of the rest of it, one of the great problems that you have with these things is trying to get them from scales where each cell is 100 miles square down to one where it's 10 miles square. And that's the question that you're asking is, can we get the definition of these things down to scales that you and I think about when we're doing this? If you think about it more on a watershed scale, I don't know what the James River watershed is, a couple thousand square kilometers or something, then you start getting into scales where you can start thinking about it. Sort of the most recent generation of these models suggest that at least in the Middle Atlantic region, the actual rainfall annually isn't going to change that much. It's going to get warmer, which gives you the warm winter problem that Ryan has talked about. But what you're going to get is that the rain's going to come in these more intense bursts. So there would be a general propensity to have more large storms interspersed with generally drier periods, at least. And if you think about that, that's actually sort of not a very good thing. It doesn't tell you whether or not you're going to get 3 hurricanes in amongst the whole dry summer. But all of the big models tend to go that way. And so the best we can do in terms of answering your question is, I think, to suggest that, is it going to get warmer? Yes. I think we all agree on that. And if we had to lean somewhere, we're probably going to get more big pressures. The total amount of water probably doesn't change that much. Although, having said that, last year was horrible. We still have the salinity signal from last year sitting around. Predicting forwards, though, is extraordinarily difficult to do.
How much does flash runoff? I mean, for example, my daughter just moved to Northern Virginia, west of Dulles Airport. That area is basically exploding in growth. Trees are being cut, land is being cleared, and when you get 4, 5, 6 inches of rain, it's going one place. That's the Potomac River. But how much do you all look into and determine how much area is being converted a year, or over a 10-year period, for example, in Chesapeake Bay, to determine how much more flash runoff we're going to have, as opposed to being able to absorb these big rainfalls?
I don't think I have that data, but I'm sure that somebody is doing it in terms of urban planning, because your other big component of that is groundwater recharge. In urban areas, that's a major problem. That would be a question for large urban planners.
Okay. So that was MSX resistance. With regard to dermo, so dermo is a bit of a, it's a different issue. I mean, dermo is, MSX will disappear in some years because of the low salinities, because of whatever the cycling is of that intermediate host. Prakinsis never disappears. It's always present. Where the salinities are high enough, it's always going to be present at 80% prevalence. It's not as bad every year as it is, every other year. What do we see in terms of sort of the long-term trends? I mean, we have more Prakinsis generally now than we've ever had. The last, like I said at the beginning of the talk, the last sort of several years, the last sort of decade, we've had more Prakinsis than we had the first decade after the 1980s intensification of the parasite. That being said, we can look at a few different things that are sort of promising. First, with regard to this question of, is there any resistance whatsoever in dermo? What I have in this graph here in blue, this is the abundance of heavy infections in wild oysters from our fall survey. So this is how many oysters have the really serious lethal Prakinsis infections, or the heaviest of the heavies. There would probably be another scale below the heavies that I have on the graph that could still kill an oyster in September, October. But these are the heaviest of the infections. And in red, this is in those naive, highly susceptible Rappahannock River oysters, the spring imports that we plant on the York River to watch them get sick. Those naive oysters that we plant from the upper Rappahannock that have never seen Prakinsis, in that red trend on the graph, they develop more high-intensity infections than the wild oysters that have been long exposed to Prakinsis.
The system has detected that a minimum number of lines are connected to this conference. Do you want to continue your meeting? Track 1 to confirm. If there is no...
There we go.
They call that.
So the wild oysters look a lot better than the spring imports do. A lot fewer of the very, very intense infections. And we see this sort of, you know, all through our survey relative to susceptible oysters. We generally will see a lot of Prakinsis infections, but we won't see that many very, very intense infections. The bigger story with regard to, that suggests a certain level of resistance of the wild oysters that have been long exposed to that parasite. The bigger story, I think, with regards to sort of the recent trends in oyster abundance is a change in oyster tolerance. And what we're looking at here, the orange background, and this is a graph one of my students prepared, the orange background is the Prakinsis dermo weighted prevalence trend that you've already seen with that very high spike in the middle from 1999 to 2002. The orange line and the red line represent, the orange is the area of oyster tissue as we evaluate it microscopically that's dedicated to gonad production. And the red, that's the orange line, the red line is the density of mature eggs in that same microscopic section that we're evaluating. And we see with regard to both of those metrics, you know, the numbers bounce around from the 1988 to 2002 period, and they both jump up in 2003, suggesting that something different was happening in terms of the oyster interaction with the parasites, with both parasites, beginning around 2003. So this, you know, baked into all of what you've seen from really all three of us was this change, like a fundamental increase in oyster abundance that started growing up, you know, from basically around 2003, as the oysters started doing something different. I've already told you that the dermo and MSX backgrounds really haven't changed, and if anything, Prakinsis is higher, but the oysters are doing better. So there's a suggestion that there has been some level of increase in tolerance or improved performance, and what we think we're seeing here in this analysis that basically looks microscopically at how much of an oyster is it able to dedicate to reproduction, that has quantitatively increased at that point in time and remained generally relatively higher. So we think we're seeing an indication in this that, yeah, the oysters are, after time and after many years of very, very intense disease exposure, that they're finally gaining some traction and able to perform a little bit better. So just to conclude with a couple slides, you know, what does this mean and where do we go with it? First, the evidence abounds of an oyster response to diseases. You know, we see lots of evidence in our data that suggests that the oysters are interacting better than they were with regard to both MSX and dermo. So we see decreased mortality, MSX resistance, dermo tolerance and resistance. And, you know, we see in the surveys basically that Roger and Missy are doing with VMRC, you know, decreased mortality, increased oyster longevity, not to 10 or 12 years, but they're not dying at 1 year of age either. You know, as gauged in sort of box counts that aren't as high as they used to be, and these gradual accumulations of you know, submarket and market size oysters that we're seeing throughout the system. And really what that, and sort of where we go with all this is sort of on what scale, you know, do we do restoration, or what scale do we do replenishment and that kind of thing. What matters? And circling back to this concept of like the mega projects, you know, where the money should be spent on managing oysters. Should we only do it in Harris Creek, you know, for example? Or if we can't spend, you know, $5 million in a given system, it's not worth doing it at all. You know, are bigger projects better? Are the smaller projects truly ineffective as is being suggested? And, you know, what our data seem to suggest to us is that, you know, the adaptation to disease is probably the most important thing that's going on with regard to the oysters in the region, because it's happening at such a broad scale. You know, it's not happening like only at Wreck Shoal or only at, you know, Deep Rock or only at Broad Creek, but it's happening throughout, you know, the geography of the Virginia part of Chesapeake Bay. And that anything that we can do at that scale to take advantage of what the oysters are doing at that scale, you know, may be better suited than, you know, a mega project that's spending, you know, $5 million in one place to take advantage of those improvements in the oyster that's happening at that broad scale. Which, you know, I mean, to come all the way around to, you know, the Marine Resources Commission and its activities, you know, which, you know, may have been discounted at some time as, well, what's, I mean, you're planting a little bit of shell on a reef, like, how, you know, you're not spending like $10 million, you know, at, every little bit that's happening at every scale is probably important with regard to giving the oysters a chance to better do what they're already doing with regard to these parasite interactions. So, you know, the money doesn't need to be spent all in one place, you know, and it doesn't need to be done, you know, all only by the, you know, the Bay Foundation or something. Like, anything that's happening at a dispersed scale, community level activities, you know, is going to be meaningful with regard to improving the resource. That's all I have.
I have one question, Ryan, real quick. Does the Dermo and MX, does it affect the sterile triploid type oyster?
Yeah, it affects those, you know, really, I mean, all the domesticated oysters are selected for resistance. So they're relatively resistant to Prakinsis. They form about equivalently to the wild oysters nowadays, because the wild oysters are catching up in resistance. You know, they're relatively MSX resistant, but they're about the same as the wild oysters. The thing about all the domesticated oysters, whether they're triploid or diploid, is that they're bred to run. You know, they sprint to market size, and then they're out of the water before either of the diseases catches up to them. So that's the primary benefit there.
And do you have any idea of losing ground in these low salinity environments on resistance? Do you think, you know, why it's good for us growing oysters that disease levels are down? Do you think it has a chance of actually taking resistance backwards, or would it just kind of stop where it's at?
You mean like the big freshwater events?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, I when I think about this, you know, I mean, we don't want to see a lot of oysters die in these events, but, you know, I think if we can envision a silver lining with regard to these major fresh events, it's that they're purging these upriver areas of very susceptible oysters. You know, so all those oysters at Ross Rock are gone, and Deepwater Shoal are gone, and when they come back, they're going to be restored, you know, by the natural recruitment that's happening in the middle part of these rivers. You know, that larvae that's produced at, you know, Moratico and, you know, Point of Shoal and Wreck Shoal, that's what's going to, you know, eventually make it up to the upper part of the river. Those are more susceptible oysters that are going to be settling there. So there's the real possibility, and there's a lot of modeling data, you know, in terms of how oyster populations, you know, are actually functioning, that suggests that, yeah, they wax and wane, especially in the upper part of the river because of the freshet events, in the lower part of the river because of, you know, high predation, but it's the middle parts of these, you know, the bay in general, the, you know, each tributary, Delaware Bay is the same, it's the middle parts that are most kind of important over the long run, and it's from the middle that the upper and the lower are constantly sort of resupplied as they kind of wax and wane. So I would think that, if anything, you know, we might see an improvement in the low salinity areas based on, you know, what's going to happen in terms of the recovery from this low salinity event.
And does water depth have any variance on disease? Are all of these die-offs that we see in the deeper water, that pretty sure that's all anoxia?
Yeah. We don't have any reason to believe that there's anything related specifically to disease, you know, and water level. But you know, these additional stressors that are coming in and challenging, you know, maybe in a way that's already a bit stressed from MSX that may not have been lethal otherwise. I mean, that, there could be an interaction there that would tip oysters over the edge. But.
Thanks. That was a good presentation.
Thanks.
Yep. All right. Thank you very much.
Well, we don't have a lot of time scheduled there left on our meeting, but I think I hope that gave everyone a lot to think about there as we do go forward. Sort of some takeaways that I gathered from some of that were that, you know, what Ryan just talked about there with the silver lining in terms of this freshet activity and the disease tolerance that we've seen is sort of a reason for Rexroll Sanctuary, for example, and some of those areas that haven't been harvested on in the Rappahannock that will provide this disease-resistant oysters to those areas that may have suffered from those freshets. So it's one of those things that the next couple of years with that freshet activity we might have been knocked down a little bit, but you know, there's a future there if we keep things sort of relatively the way that they are now. So we'll sort of see that fluctuation go, but sort of the way that we've been managing so far with a combination of shell planting, small sanctuary areas intermixed with our harvest rotation areas seems to have put us in a sort of more resilient pattern than we would otherwise be with these increased rain events, potential for climate change and all that. And hopefully sea level rise perfectly balances out the increased rain flow and the oysters will stay right where they are, but you know, maybe not. But. I guess just a little bit to think about before we go next year, the areas that are scheduled if we don't make any changes to open would be areas 2 and 4 in the Rappahannock, York Area 2, that's Timberneck, just above the bridge, Tangier, Pocomoke Area 1, that's Johnson's, Hurley's, Fox Island, and Hancock, Bird, and Marshall's there, and the Great Wicomico, the upper portion area, so above Tolls Creek North, between Tolls Creek and the Great Wicomico Light, would sort of be our rotation that we'd be coming into if we didn't make any changes. That's just something to think about going forward, as well as, you know,
York River,
Timberneck area there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about the James?
The James hasn't been on an actual different rotation there, but the discussion that we started there with the seed areas, we might look into some sort of change in management and how we're managing those, particularly those areas that are getting worked down in terms of not having a whole area open to seed for the full time period. Something that we want to look at carefully there. And I mean, there is something to think about in terms of what we saw this last season, the season that we're just coming off of, in terms of the shifts that we saw and where harvest effort was focused. So one area, like the Rappahannock, wasn't what was expected, that pushes that effort elsewhere. So the length of the season, particularly if you have bad areas, can sort of shift large portions of that to other areas and do more damage for those areas that had a chance to recover. So that's something that, in terms of what we're doing, in terms of length of season, year types, just something to look at in terms of planning for this next season. And also something to consider as we try to, I hope, look past just this one season and try to look at 5, 10, 20 years down the line. It's one of those things that we need to kind of be aware of, that eventually the fossil shells will either get too expensive or run out of areas to work. And that sort of is something that we need to keep in the back of our mind. And that source won't always be there. It'll be there in the near term. But it's something to look at when we're considering the amount of other shell sources that we're planting, alternative substrate, and the way that we manage our seed fishery, to try to get these areas up to where levels where they can be as sustainable as we can with the resources that we'll have to keep them replenished 5, 10, 20 years down the line if we don't have what we have now. So that's all yep. Something to consider.
Andrew, when do you think you'll have most of the information on the bars that will be considered for opening this coming season?
Well, we have all of the updated 2018 fall patentong survey area, so there's not going to be really time and manpower to conduct a full survey of all these areas, but we can do some spot checks in terms of increases in mortality that we've seen
prior to setting a season date. Probably by the end of June, we'll have been to all these areas and can sort of get an idea with a small dredge or a couple patent tongue grabs if there's large increases in mortality. I mean, I suspect that what we'll see in some of these areas is similar to what we've seen in last years of, you know, a little bit of an increase, and by a little bit I mean in that 15 to 25% in some areas, probably the deep water areas, which doesn't seem like much, but when that's 15 to 25% of your market oysters, that can be more significant, particularly to the harvesters. So not catastrophic, but
the commission usually makes its final decision on what's the seasons are going to be and limits and so on and so forth at the end of the September meeting. Is that correct?
We tried to do it a little earlier in August, but we can, if we need sort of more information, delay that a little bit to September, but that doesn't give folks as much time to prepare for the season there. If it's, you know, end of August, you don't know, or end of September, and opening day is October 1st there. But that's something to look at is adjusting that length of the season there. I think, you know, this year particularly with the shift in effort that we saw there, there might have been some areas that could have been opened a little later to sort of spread that effort out. So it's something to think about as we go forward.
Probably July and August, we're going to have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I'd like to try to get another meeting in June, late of June, probably two or three more before we actually settle a season there. So.
One suggestion, Andrew, going forward on these gear types, I would really like to see on the hand scrape that we use an actual number of effort instead of licenses sold.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we get requests from folks that actually want to show 5 bushels just because of the fear of losing licenses. So, you know, realistic usage.
Okay, yeah, no, I can give
I understand the argument on latent activity and this, that, and the other, but the reality is that we all know most of these folks took advantage of the user fee concept when it came out and don't want to lose their licenses. And, you know, to make real decisions, I think we need a good transparent number to work with.
Okay, yeah, no, we can do a breakdown of sort of days of harvest by gear type. It'll sort of look similar to one of Roger's graphs there, as you'll see a big peak and then some slacks on either end in terms of high harvest and low harvest. But yeah, we can put that together. Is there anything else we got?
Andrew, just can you address the James River seed situation from that? Where are we in harvest? I mean, we're coming to the end of the season. How much have we under harvested this year on the 120,000 that we set aside? We cut the harvest off in maybe early December at 40,000. Saving 80,000 for the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we tried to do two things. Last year we tried to address the situation that Virginia individuals who wanted resource to go in Virginia didn't get last year because we exported a lot to Maryland. This year it may have flip-flopped and we may be in a situation where there could have been more Virginia harvest to sell outside the state that hasn't gotten satisfied. Therefore we've left product on the table that could have been harvested if we had it.
Right.
So where do we stand with the whole James River situation at this point?
Well, of the 120,000 total quota, I believe around 52,000 as of early this week is left. But the other thing to consider with 52,000.
Okay, out of 120.
Out of 120.
Okay.
So the other thing to consider is what we were shown on those slides there, that in terms of what Roger went over there in terms of point of shoals and some of those areas, the concern was is if that 50,000 bushels came from a focused area, that could continue to bring that downward trend that we seen there. That combined with upwards of 90% mortality that we've seen in some of the seed areas. So it might be something that we want to look at is actually adjusting that 120,000 bushel quota. That might be too high where it's set now.
Horsehead diet, is that deemed or not?
Portions, there is increased mortality in horsehead, deep water, shoals, some of the upriver areas there. And if you look at Burwell Bay area, you'll see some of the deeper areas, some of the areas where there might have been a ribbon of fresh water have come through. So it's not evenly spread out where the mortality is, but overall, definitely increased mortality in the upper river areas as you go down. But there are some pockets of higher mortality that come across parts of Horsehead, parts of Point of Shoals even, where you do see, you know, pretty high levels of mortality there.
We looked at people like what we have up there, and we had a lot of mortality last June, and then we had a lot of strike last summer.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at it on Tuesday this week, and we had almost 100% mortality this winter. I don't know when, but sometimes whether we have at least, you know, recent, didn't die in the last week or two, but it's been dead for some time.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, a lot of shells are there.
Yeah, well, it's one of those is hopefully those disease-tolerant oysters from wreck shoals strike up there this year, and it needs to stop raining here for a while. But those areas do periodically experience that, and as long as the shell's there, they can recover. But one of the reasons for keeping wreck shoals where it is that's, as Ryan was talking about, one of those big areas in the middle of a river that provides disease-resistant strike up and down. And all that seed that we're moving from Nansen Ridge, that's going to be moved up to Moratico, Waterview, up to Pocomoke there. And presumably, that'll be more disease-tolerant oysters that we're moving to those areas.
I got a question. All these fossil shells that we're taking and we're putting on NASMIN,
mm-hmm.
and how come you don't put more shell on NASMIN, and instead of just planting shells in some of these places and these shells, plant the oysters there, they get such a great strike there?
Well, most of the areas that we did plant with fossil shell, those areas tend to get a pretty decent spat set. Not nearly as good as they have been at NASMIN there, but it's one of those, it's more cost effective to plant shells and get a spat set than it is to plant shells, get a spat set, dredge those shells, and then transplant them again. So we try to move seed to areas that don't get a set, usually, and try to plant shells in areas that, with some exceptions, such as 2018, generally don't get a set. But the areas that did receive fossil shell in the summer of 2018 did get higher sets than most of the areas that either received no shell then. So it's one of those. 2018 was a little bit of an anomaly, but the areas in the lower Rappahannock that got fossil shell planted on them got a decent spat set, and some of the areas there in Tangier Sound that got fossil shell got a pretty good spat set too. So it's, and we're definitely doing more planting there in Nansen Ridge, so we're going to continue planting that to have as an option going forward. But it's definitely something we're looking at expanding and continuing, both that and the normal shell planting. And it, especially if we go forward, if we start running low on substrate, it might be something that we looking forward, if we only have a limited amount of shell, we'd want to plant it where we get the most set and then move it from there. So.
Any other questions?
Is there any other, Tommy had some good information there. Is there any other information that you'd like myself or our colleagues from VIMS try to put together before we go to a next meeting there, or any information that you think would be helpful in making decisions as we go towards our next harvest season and future seasons?
I think we need as much information as we can get on the James River seed areas and what the shell bases look like,
mm-hmm.
so we can make an educated decision on quota for next year.
Yeah. No,
definitely a resource that we can.
And you will be checking Area 2 in the Rappahannock?
We're going to try to get out and check areas that are scheduled to open in the Rappahannock prior to setting the season there. So, and we did resurvey a portion of the seed areas there in the James River this year, so we can go over that the next meeting too.
Anything else?
I think that's everything. Thank you for coming, and welcome to Fort Monroe here. So hopefully the tunnel traffic kinder than it was yesterday going back, if you're going that way.
Yeah, we want to thank the contingency from VIMS and all their information. It's very valuable, and we appreciate it.
You're welcome, sir.
The disease aspect was really a good...
I guess we'll adjourn the meeting and hope to hear from Mr. Button on our next one.
Thank you.